Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol. For this next episode, I joined Dr. Adam Burley, clinical psychologist and professional lead of the River Centre here in Edinburgh, which is NHS Lothian's specialist service for people affected by trauma. I've been wanting to meet Adam for ages, ever since hearing about his work at the RCGP conference through Dr. Carrie Lunan. Of course, not all patients suffering from alcohol harms have underlying trauma, but I think it's highly relevant for a lot of folk, and I hope you find his insights on relational injury and our own healthcare worker dependency phobia as thought-provoking as I did. Although Adam now leads the River Centre, he worked for over 18 years in the Edinburgh Homeless Access Practice, so he is no ivory tower psychologist and in fact a keen advocate for primary care level general psychologists. He would argue that for many, continuity of care is the treatment, and that understanding the extent of relational injury many of our patients have experienced should not burden us further, but help us be kind to ourselves and realistic about what we can do for others and how they will see us. I'm delighted to be sitting here in this beautiful Brutalist Art Deco River Centre NHS Lothian with its director, clinical psychologist, Dr. Adam Burley. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Rachel. Good to be here too.
So can we start just by asking, what do you mean by relational injury? And what's its relevance to addiction?
I think my starting point would be, I guess, an idea that at our core, all of us are relational beings, and that from our first moments in the world, we are in need of being in a relationship to get something of our basic psychological and physical needs met. In fact, to the point where if we didn't get into a relationship pretty quickly, following birth,
We would die.
We would die, to put it bluntly. Winnicott, the famous psychoanalyst, I'm sure your listeners all be aware of his work, had a sort of euphemistic phrase of, the child will no longer be a going concern, which I assume he means by that, yes, they will be dead. And so I guess from a psychological point of view, relationships could be thought of as the absolute fundament to psychological life and physical life. I will talk more about psychological life, I guess. And so from the very beginning, our existence is dependent upon them. Now, if all goes well, we might be lucky enough to find ourselves in a relationship with somebody who can recognize our needs and attend to them in a way that is good enough, that sort of meets the basic requirements and allows us to live, and if we're lucky, grow and develop and find out what Lego does and what a banana tastes like and what it's like to stick your hand down the plug hole and all sorts of things in relation to somebody who keeps us safe and sets some limits around what we might do, if we're lucky. And if we have that, we may not even notice actually that we're in a relationship with somebody. My sort of favourite example of this, I guess, is my own son has been in full-time residential treatment for 18 years. He just doesn't know it. He's just been happily living along in the house, having two full-time carers who have paid attention to most of his needs, hopefully in a good enough way, for about 18 years.
For free?
For free. And is he ready? Not quite yet. Here at River Centre, we work with people affected by what we call various things, complex developmental trauma, early adversity, mistreatment, all sorts of things that I would say speak to experiences that happened within developmental relationships. Most, if not all, trauma tends to happen, certainly through early life, tends to happen in relation to another. And often, not unusually, to the person who the child may have expected to be the person who provides the care and the support and the understanding and the containment. But we know that's not always the case. And so we may have people whose early experiences of being in relationship with people, with others, have been run through with pain, anxiety, uncertainty, fear, threat, a complete lack of safety, a complete lack of reliability or containment, or all of the things that we might have taken so for granted that we didn't notice we even had them in our history. And so try and, I guess, capture the impact that that can have on us as people. I suppose I came up with the term relational injury to try and make it concrete in a way, to sort of try and articulate that this is an injury. It's an injury to a very core part of human function and process. And like a very severe spinal injury, say, through development, can have long-lasting and profound impacts, not just through the developmental stage of life, but across the person's lifespan, really.
And that's really, really helpful. We see it all the time in our work. Some folk just have a natural default ability to recognise their needs and get them met, and some folk absolutely don't have that ability.
I think that's really key, that bit about noticeability, because I think one of the things that strikes me, or keeps striking me, I guess, is the idea that within healthcare, we may have a slightly overvalued idea that everybody has equal relational access to care. As you were saying, that everybody has a relatively equal capacity to come along, trust a caregiver, share a vulnerability with them, listen to what the caregiver says, take it on board, make use of it, and from that grow and develop. And I guess the idea of relational injury is to sort of highlight an idea that there may be a group of people who have learned the complete opposite, actually, that what they have learned, not through any choice of their own, but just by virtue of being in the life that they've been in, they have learned that to have a need, to have any vulnerability, is extremely dangerous. To seek attachment, to seek care, to be dependent on somebody, to need somebody, is one of the most dangerous, crazy ideas you could ever have. And I should clarify, not an idea. That suggests that in some way it's just
a conceptual option.
Yes, rather than structurally, they know that it's not safe to do so. It's much more profound than that. It's in with the architecture in some way.
And I would argue, having listened to you now, it's not just the patients might be wary of that need, but I think as doctors, we're very wary of that. I know you've talked about dependency phobia in the healthcare system, and you know, I've definitely been trained with this notion that I'm not doing a good job as a GP if my patients become dependent on me, that that's not actually doing them a service, and this, my ego is involved there in an unhelpful way, and we need to make sure our patients are not dependent on us. What do you think of that?
I think, and I really want to caveat what I might be about to say with all sorts of caveats, really, to say that this is not the case for everybody. And I think my default setting would always be to really try and think about where the person is who we're in relation to as a doctor or as a psychologist, what might the needs be, and what's our understanding of what the difficulties are. For some reason, I think in the area of mental health, we do have something of a dependency phobia, which I think has always made me think at some level we also have an understanding that for some people, dependency may well be the requirement if we were to really address what the core injury is. If we took it to its rather daft but sort of logical extreme, if we said when you have a child and you bring it home from hospital and the midwife, the health visitor comes around and says to you, now look, be careful, this child may try and foster dependency upon you. We wouldn't recommend you do that. We recommend you try and, you know, limit that in some way. And of course, that's the complete opposite of what we tend to be advised to do, which is we would want to foster attachment and connection and dependency. That actually dependency is necessary. It's a very important and fundamental part of development, that we are all start dependent. I might even argue that never really stops, that we all, if we're lucky and our early dependencies are good enough, then we may leave home at some point and form other dependencies upon work colleagues and partners and
Bicycles.
And records and all sorts of things that keep our sanity together in some sort of basic way. And it interests me in healthcare that there's some presentations that we're not too worried about the dependency of. So if somebody, for example, does have a spinal injury that might require relatively lifelong input around bowel management or physiotherapy or whatever it might be, we don't seem to have so much of a problem with that.
Mm.
But when it comes to relational dependency, I think we get much more concerned about it. Even if somewhere in our formulation and understanding, we might recognize that this person never had the sort of relational experiences that we were lucky to have that allowed us to go off and form healthy dependencies. So yeah, I think it's very understandable that we're phobic of it, because in some level, the ask of some people may be to such a degree that we cannot manage it within the caseloads that we have, or the time limits that we have, or the structures that we have, because we don't currently, as far as I know, within the health service, have a trust repair service or a relational injury repair service that might run along the developmental timescales and the small caseloads that might be required to address such a
I'm
a
imagining
difficulty.
GPs listening to us, Adam, as they're walking their dog or doing their dishes, screaming at the their phone saying, you know, I'm not these people's parent, I'm exhausted, I can't cope with this amount of requirement of dependency, and I'm terrified of it. I don't want to be told that, you know, folks have such deep relational injury that they need my help in containing so much. And we're not, just to be clear, we're not advocating for GPs to somehow be psychotherapists at the same time, but just to understand that for some folk, and not everyone, the relational injury is so deep, it will lead to very understandable counterproductive behaviour. And I suppose if we can at least understand that, that's the first step, even if we're not going to be equipped to necessarily deal with it. Is that what you would say in reply to the GPs?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good point, because I think even as I'm talking, I can hear the screaming. And I would even say it myself, that like, it's not to suggest that is what should be being done. Far from it, actually. It strikes me that one of the things that's very difficult in primary care is that you are you're working in an area of discrepancy in all sorts of areas, not least of which this area, where the demand that's coming in through the door of what the actual ailment is, and all the variables that go to make up the ailment, whether that's poverty, poor housing, unemployment, severe childhood adversity, you don't have the resources available to you, which in itself can be incredibly stressful. So it's not to highlight this to sort of almost
give us another thing.
Yeah, because I really don't think that's the case, which I suppose is why I sort of jokingly talk about a trust repair service. And I'm not sure, you know, I mean, it could be in primary care, and it may well be best placed in primary care. Whether it should be being done by GPs in their current, of course not, because they don't have that space or that time to, or support actually, to do that and work in that way. But I suppose I want to highlight it because I do think it's a very real thing that we don't tend to make a huge amount of adaptation and accommodation for or provision for. But as an injury, I think it's one of the most severe and life-limiting injuries that you can have. To be a human being who has become, as you say, understandably phobic, deeply phobic of the business of being a human being. If by being a human being we understand that to be needing connection and attachment and relationships with other people in some way.
You had a really good analogy about language fluency, and that actually one of your patients.
Yeah. Somebody I'd worked with for a long time and who I would say, you know, actually by her own admission would say that she felt it was a good description of what her life-limiting condition was a relational injury. And she noticed it across the board in terms of a capacity to form connections with anybody, really. Not that there wasn't a part of her that wanted to, But there were other parts of her that would robustly tell her this was a very, very bad idea. Over time, she managed to... she worked very hard at trying to work in that area and try and see relationships in slightly different ways, part of which involved at some point actually going to college. And there she was learning some early developmental psychology and was learning about critical periods of development, which I'm sure listeners will understand is sort of very early periods in life where we learn things and we learn them relatively unconsciously and we learn them relatively deep. And she'd been fascinated by this idea that if a child isn't exposed to language in the first 5 or 6 years of life, then they will never speak a language fluently. Like they, not like we're talking now, they may learn a language, but it will be something learnt afterwards. It will always be a second language. And she'd sort of made the connection that for her, given that her, when I first met her, her first 2 pages of the Bible that she had written through her development was 1, everyone is an asshole. And 2, don't trust anyone. And she wasn't messing about. They were very, very serious rules to keep her safe. And here she was, and she'd come, been at college one day, and she'd spoken about her learning sport teacher, and she said, oh, and Alison said this, and I trust her. And I said, oh, that's interesting. So you're trusting people now, are you?
Yeah.
And she said, well, I think I will always speak trust as a second language. That in some way she recognized her mother tongue, her first language, is I don't trust anybody. And just like us with our language, I mean, I've learned English growing up. Can I remember when I learned English? No. Could I ever unlearn English? No. Probably not. It's sort of in with the bricks. And so this idea that trust or a range of sort of psychological qualities may be learnt through core critical developmental periods in the way that language is, or riding a bike, or tying your shoelaces, in ways that are... We don't learn consciously, but we learn deeply and are almost impossible to unlearn. And I think what she was saying is something around, I may never learn untrust, but I may be able to speak trust as a second language in a way that would be good enough for me to negotiate a GP appointment, for example, or learn something at college, or make a friend.
Yeah.
You know, these really basic things that a lot of us might take for granted.
I actually find that analogy so helpful, because for me it's realistic that if you miss out on language learning, the language of trust relationship first time round, then you're never going to have it as a natural mother tongue.
Yeah.
So it seems to me realistic, but then hopeful that you can learn it as a second language and that people can... There's still hope, you know, if you missed out first time round. I mean, as you talk, I'm thinking of a few of my patients that are coming to my mind, you know, with really difficult early lives. And I'm even thinking of maybe even using this analogy out loud explicitly with them to see if it resonates. You know, would that be helpful? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know either. I certainly don't have much data on it other than my own experience. I think where I think I've found it useful is, a bit like you're saying, to sort of bring some realism into what might be possible for us, I guess, as clinicians who may be labouring under an idea that we really need to address this person's substance use or their depression or their mental health problems or whatever it might be. Like it's something more superficial than it might be, rather than recognising, like we would never say to someone with a spinal injury, don't worry, we'll get you up and running again, like that would be possible, that we would recognise the parameters of the injury. And that's not to lose hope, because as I think as that patient describes, I think there is, we have a capacity to build on the parts of ourselves who are still looking for connection. Because I think that's very hard. Again, I think that's a very, very hard thing to extinguish. That you can learn things on top of it that say, okay, trusting people is bad, making connections is bad. But I don't think it kills off
the desire,
the other part. You know, so it's like the patient who comes to see you relentlessly.
Yes.
Just to tell you how crap you are.
Exactly.
And how you're doing nothing for them.
Yes.
Why are you here?
Yes. Because there's, because and there's the some fact part that they're still coming back. Yeah. And I think that's why I'm finding your work helpful, is not that it is necessarily adds to our workload, but actually might help us be less hard on ourselves. Because if we can understand the sheer magnitude of the existing injury in a patient long before they met us, that might help us reset our expectations of ourselves and our work and our patient.
Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.